Well, as a few more folks make their way in, I want to encourage you to think with me for a minute. What do we need for this next hour to be successful or productive in your mind? In other words, what do we hope will happen here so that it's not just a waste of your time and mine? What comes to thought? What comes to mind? Other than a clicker, we need a clicker that works. Okay, we're going to talk about God about that. What else? Keeping what? Keeping our sins confessed, okay? Anything else? What do we need for this to be a successful or productive time together? Thanks, babe. A humble, open heart. Great. Prayer. Okay. Any other input? Undistracted minds. Okay. You guys have all been way too shy about saying we need someone up here teaching who has some clarity of mind and knows where they're going and can communicate and doesn't lose their voice and all kinds of things. So we need to just have humble, repentant hearts. We need to be attentive. We need God to speak to us, to reveal things to us. I need God's help to work through this material in a way that's helpful and understand some of your questions and comments. So the reason I raise those as questions is I'm going to ask now for some of you, maybe two or three, to ask God to do what we want him to do this morning, right? Because he's present here, and he is in a disposition to work among us. And so it'd be fitting, I think, for us to ask God to do that. If we come here with the expectation that we want to see God work in our lives, let's ask him to do some of those things for us. So I'm not going to call on you by name. I'm just going to give a couple of you an opportunity. Pray loud so the rest of us can join you, and let's do that to get started. Amen. All right. Thank you. So I think it's a good question to ask, isn't it? What do we need? What do we want God to do? Sometimes we just kind of barge right into prayer and just whatever comes to mind, but just asking the question, what do we want God to do among us? So let's just quickly go over what I'm hoping to accomplish together this morning. I wanted us to just review the foundations of human need that we spent some time on last week, and then we're going to look at three important questions that everyone should be asking just by way of review. Then I want us to correlate some components of human behavior to the analogy of a fruit tree, and then begin to answer the question, why do people do the things that they do? And then after that, I want to spend a few minutes clarifying what the function of the heart is, and then after that, develop the capacity to recognize the chain of command from controlling root to the producing fruit that's taking place in everyone's lives. And then finally, we'll begin to identify a strategy for fruit-producing life change. So with that, as our agenda for this morning, let's go ahead and review the foundation of human need and key questions everyone needs to ask. So last week, we took a look at three passages. We looked at Genesis 1. And a couple verses in Genesis 2. We looked at Genesis 3, 1 through 7, which is typically called the narrative of the fall of man. And then we looked at a couple of passages in Hebrews 3, 12 and 13, and 10, 24 and 25. So based on those three passages, either recollection from our discussion last week or maybe your general familiarity with those passages, what are some things that all humans need that come out of those passages? What can you remember? What are your thoughts on that? Okay, so God is specifically creating mankind, okay? All right. And Gary, can you remember what specifically happens in there? What does God do or say in that passage? Okay, so he creates mankind, male and female, creates him in his image, he creates him, he says it's good. Okay, someone said he creates them for a relationship. Okay, any other thoughts? What's the Genesis 2 narrative about? What's God do with Adam? Okay, so he puts him in the garden. He says he's supposed to work it, okay? But that's not all he does. What happens after that? There's a parade of animals, right, going in front of Adam. And then what happens? Okay, God said it's not good for what? Man to be alone. And so he creates woman. And the whole universe went, yeah! Isn't that awesome? That's how I imagine it, anyway. So what's interesting about Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 is that sometimes we think the reason humans have all these needs is because they fell into a rut in Genesis 3 and the whole world fell apart, and so we have all these needs. But in fact, what we find, God actually created humans with need. He didn't just plop them in the garden and leave them to themselves, but he actually gave them a word of direction. He said, this is what you need to do. This is the purpose for which I created you. He didn't just leave man alone in the garden, but he created a counterpart fit for him so that together, independence on one another, they might fulfill their purpose. So human beings were created to be people of need. It's not just a flaw in our composition. It's how we were designed to be. In fact, that you require to breathe in every second of your life and eat food is a demonstration that God didn't create you to be these autonomous beings without any need, but actually he wanted you to live a dependent lifestyle. So we've got the Genesis 1 and 2 narrative. Genesis 3, I don't want to spend a ton of time there, which is where Adam and Eve listen to the voice of Satan. They take some fruit that was forbidden. They listen to some lies, embrace some promises, and so they sin, rebel against God, and that really did turn the world upside down and bring it into the curse of sin and rebellion against God. And then lastly, we looked at Hebrews, a couple passages in Hebrews 3, which, interestingly enough, Jesus comes, he saves us from the curse of sin, and he redeems us. We're no longer under condemnation, but we still have need, right? Because in these passages, what we find is the encouragement to take care, lest our hearts become hardened and fall in deception of sin. And we need to be encouraging and exhorting one another daily, right? And stirring up one another to love and good deeds. And so even as Christians post this great redemptive event where Christ has saved us from all that plagued us under condemnation, we're still intended to live as people that are dependent on God and dependent on one another. So that's a general framework for the sense that we continue to live as a redeemed people who are meant to have our needs met in dependence on God and one another. So with that, let's consider then some key questions that we just introduced briefly last week. We'll continue to look at these as we go on in our class. But these three questions are, why do people do the things they do? Second question, how does lasting change take place in a person's life? And finally, how can I be an instrument of change in the life of another person? So, just quickly, don't put a ton of deep thought into it, but put a star next to the one of those three questions that you feel like you're most confident or competent to be able to answer. Like, you feel like you could say, this is why people do what they do, or this is how lasting change takes place in a person's life, or this is the kind of instrument that I'm supposed to be in that process. So put a star next to the one that you think, yeah, I would rank that top on the three. Doesn't mean you're an expert, but of those three, which one do you put on the top? And then the one that you feel least confident about, the one that kind of raises the most questions, just put a question mark next to that, all right? So I'm not going to ask you to explain your answers, but let's just take a quick survey. Who put a star next to number one? Why people do the things they do, okay? All right, so a few of you. How many of you put a star next to lasting change, how lasting change takes place in a person's life, okay? A few more probably, I'd say. And then finally, the last question, how can I be an instrument of change in the life of another person? Okay, and probably a few more, but that was the least of all in terms of highest level of confidence. How can I be that agent of change in someone else's life? Well, we're going to continue to look at that. I hope that in the process of our time together, regardless of where you're at in any of those three questions, you'll feel that you've raised the bar a little bit. You've made some progress. You've gained some ground in how you relate to each of those three questions. So with that, then, let's go ahead and continue on. I want us to take a look at a passage in Luke chapter 6. It's a very common passage. I'm sure all of you are acquainted with it in one way or another. But I want us to just begin to correlate the components of human behavior to a fruit tree. And then as a follow-on to that, we'll ask the question, why do people do the things they do? So as you look at this passage, I'll read it for us. I want you to be asking the question, what is the root and the tree components regarding humans and human behavior, and what is the fruit, okay? So Jesus says, for no good tree bears bad fruit, nor again does a bad tree bear good fruit, for each tree is known by its own fruit. For figs are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor are grapes picked from a bramble bush. The good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil out of the abundance of his, or for out of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaks. So a few words that I picked up out of that passage. Let's back up a little bit, Lynn. A few words I picked out of that passage. Let's just try and pin them to our tree there. Where does the heart go? You can write it in your notes. Where would you put the heart? Is it part of the root, trunk, or is it fruit? It's the root, part of the root. Okay, good. What about spoken words in our passage? Fruit, okay. All right, so it says, for out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. All right, treasure. Where does the treasure go? We're not sure about that. Some want to put it as fruit, okay. In the context of this passage, I'm putting it under the root and the trunk, and this is why, because Jesus says out of the treasure that one has stored up in their heart, they do certain things. So I'm going to put the treasure stuff, the stuff that's treasured, that's valued as being part of the root or the trunk. And then good conduct, where does that go? That's fruit, okay? All right, so what are some other examples of fruit in terms of conduct in one's life that we could hang on those branches? We've talked about words people speak. What else?
Well, the first thing I got out of that may fit into your question. Fruit ripens according to a close relationship to the sun, being exposed to the sun. Mm-hmm. S-O-N versus S-U and the sun. So our fruit ripens the closer contact we have with the sun.
Okay. So what would be a way to observe, what would be the fruit that we would observe in the tree of your life if you had that closer relationship to God? How would I see that? How would I know that? Yeah, someone's going to answer the question for you right over here. Woo, go ahead.
Obedience.
Okay, good. Actions? What kinds of actions? Okay, being kind to someone? Being selfish would be a fruit, okay? Let's put that in practical terms. What does it mean to be selfish? What does someone do that's a selfish act? Okay, so insist on having it their way. Ever tried to select a movie on movie night? You all laugh, you know. I know you know. Okay, good. Any other ideas of behavior that we can hang on the fruit branches of this tree? Accountability? Okay, so flesh that out for me a little bit. What do you mean? How is that a fruit?
depending on whether we're going to actually own up to what we should be doing, what the Lord would have us do, or not.
Okay. All right. So we might say that a person's willingness to enter into relationships with other people where they're accountable for the things that they're doing would be a fruit of certain things that are going on in their life. Okay, well, so I'm just, the intention is for us to begin to think about the fruit in our lives, that is, that the external outward behaviors that we can look around the room, and if we watch someone's life enough, we see the stuff going on, but that doesn't necessarily tell us what is going on in the heart, what's emanating from the heart. So looking at this passage again, try to paraphrase in your own words the answer that Jesus gives here in verse 45 to the question, why do people do the things they do? We've just talked about a bunch of stuff people do. They obey, they exercise kindness toward others. They're selfish in wanting the kind of meal they want or the movie they want to ask. They drive in a certain way. They're quick to serve others, to cook meals, send out thank you cards. There's just a ton of different behaviors. Looking at verse 45, I'm going to read it for us, and then I just want you to think, how would you try and put that in your own words if you were explaining it to a friend? And let's just say a non-Christian friend, someone who doesn't have all the Christianese packed up in their vocabulary lunchbox. How would you explain it? So Jesus says the good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good. The evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil. For out of the abundance of the heart, his mouth speaks. Okay, so let's try and paraphrase that. Try and tell a friend, why do people do what they do? And your answer is? Yeah, okay. Sure. Well, I think you're wrestling with and asking the question, how do we deal with seeming contradictions with what people are saying on the one hand, but what they believe is going on in their heart on the other? You did raise one phrase which caught my attention. We'll get to in a minute. You said, what do they want to say? You know, whether do they say what they want to say or not? But there's something about wants going on there that's impacting what people do. I'll get to you in just a second, Ben. Someone I think started to make a comment over here. I missed it. Okay. So the condition of a person's heart causes them to do the things that they do. Okay, that would be one today.
I think whether it's good or evil, people want to be happy. And what happy is depends on the condition of your heart. I think we're all trying to be justified. And we all struggle against self-righteousness, gaining that. But if I'm going to speak in common terms, everyone wants to feel happy. How they get to happy, and what happy is, depends on the condition.
Okay, good.
Like, say, addiction, for instance. There's lots of types of addiction. I've heard it said, you're trying to fill a God-shaped hole in your heart, right? Addiction has lots of expressions. Some are very visible, some are very invisible. But we're still all trying to be happy. We're trying to be complete.
Good. Just have a few other hands here. Okay, good. So let me just try and summarize. I think you guys are getting at the core of what's really important to understand. The fruit of what people do in their lives is directly connected to the things that they value, treasure, prioritize, want, that they believe is going to make them happy. I can't quote it perfectly, but I believe it's Blaise Pascal. He made the statement that everything that any person has ever done in their life, they've never lifted so much as a finger or done anything except in the pursuit of their own happiness. He says, even those who kill themselves, right? Even those who harm themselves do that in the pursuit of what they think is going to make them the most happy, given all things that they can consider as possible outcomes. Okay, so there is this connection to what we want, what we desire, what we treasure, value in our heart that then is connected to the mechanics of how we use our hands and feet and minds and mouth and everything else to achieve those things that we think are going to make us happy. So we'll just let it hang there. We'll continue to develop that. But let's spend a little bit of time clarifying what the function of the heart. We've been throwing this term around, the heart, quite a bit. So what is the heart? So look at these common sayings that we probably have all heard. And just talk to me a little bit. What are they telling us about people, what they have in view, referring to a person's heart? So he loves me with all his heart. What's that mean? What's the heart doing there? What's being invoked there? Okay, all right. Okay, all right. What about she recited the entire poem by heart? They recited it from admiration? Okay, so you admire the fact that they could recite something by heart. By memory, okay? So usually when someone is doing something by heart, it means they've internalized it to the fact that they can just, their brain is able to reproduce it word for word and not have to refer to external notes or what else. They played their hearts out. What's that mean? Okay, they gave it everything that they had. So their whole person, whole being was involved in trying to succeed in that effort. He wears his heart on his sleeve. What's that mean? He's sensitive. Okay, that's right. You just read his heart like a book on his sleeves. Like everybody knows, if he's feeling down, you know it. If she's excited, you know it, you know? And so it's like some people, it's just there for everyone to see, whereas others of us are a bit more private. I don't really want to let you know all that I may be thinking or feeling. That's a term we commonly use with regard to the heart. She has a heart of gold. What's that mean? What's love? Okay, so it could mean that she's someone who is a very loving person. Generous? Caring? Okay, so generally that has reference to speaking of someone's character, of someone having a good character, of being a good person. Generally, you talk about them having a heart of gold. And then what about this? His heart's desire was to ski the Swiss Alps. Does that mean he's a caring person? Okay, so his want, his deepest inner bowel want is to be on those slopes in the Swiss Alps and enjoying that. All right, so trying to think again, what do we mean when we use this term heart? You probably have heard often people make the distinction between the heart as referring to what one feels, and the mind, what one thinks, right? Okay, so what I want to do is I want us to look at several passages from the New Testament and try and assess how that distinction stands up, all right? So just look at these briefly, and it might even help you underline the activity or action that is associated with the heart. What is the heart doing in these passages? And that'll kind of help us to think, what is the function of the heart? So Matthew 9:4, Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said, "Why do you think evil in your hearts?" Mark 11:23 talks about the person that does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will come to pass and it will be done for him. Luke 3:15. As the people were in expectation and all were questioning in their hearts concerning John whether he might be the Christ. Acts 5:4. Why is it that you have contrived this deed in your heart? You have not lied to man, but to God. Acts 16:14. The Lord opened her heart to pay attention to what was said by Paul. And finally, Romans 9:2, that I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart. So with those verses in view, let's try and think, what is the function of the heart? What does the heart do? Not just one thing, but there's several things in these verses. What are they? Yeah. Okay, so the heart is determining what is valuable and not valuable. Yeah?
This is just from a nurse's perspective, I guess, but when I think of the physical heart and how it pumps blood and feeds the rest of the body, I think of the heart, emotions or whatever, and thoughts, and how it's very interwoven and works together.
Okay, all right. So drawing an analogy to a physical heart that's interconnected to all the parts of the body and so is feeding everything that's going on in life. Okay, so the heart believes or doubts certain things, right? What else? Okay, so the heart produces stuff, okay? Produces evil, produces good. Go to the back. Yeah, okay, all right. So the heart is taking in those things that could say are valuable, provide life, nutrients, and then out of the heart, those things flow to the rest of our life. So let me just put up a definition that I put together. Not terribly technical. This is my own words, so you know, don't quote me on it or hold me to account. But let me just read this and tell you why I'm mentioning this. So I think that the biblical notion of the heart has reference to the inner being of a person where all the critical functions of thinking and planning and willing and judging and feeling are seated and active. All right, and so the New Testament can make a distinction between the heart, what's going on in the heart, and what is being done outwardly in terms of conduct and behavior. But interestingly enough, the New Testament rarely, if ever, I'm actually not certain if there's even a single instance where the heart and the mind are contrasted. Okay, and so we often do this. We often say, well, the heart is what you feel, and the mind is what you think. And what I'm just saying, biblically, the heart kind of encompasses all of that, what we value and how we think, and we question our heart, and we come to some judgments about what is right and good, and we feel things in our heart in response to all of that input that we're taking into account. And out of all of that that's going on in our heart, stuff happens. People do things out of the overflow of what they have treasured, valued, questioned, determined, judged to be good or bad in their hearts. Okay? So, what's important then with that is, I think, my point is not that there's no value in saying, okay, we need heart and we need mind, we need to feel and we need to know. I think there's truth in saying, yeah, we want to be a people who not only are mentally engaged with the truths of God, but we're also affectionately engaged. You've all been around people who know a lot of stuff about a person. They might even know a lot about you, but frankly, their heart is not in it. They don't really care about you. They don't love you, right? So there is a real distinction there. I'm just trying to say that the biblical language of the heart really encompasses all of that. And so as we're running into passages and study this in Scripture, we want to have that in view. All right, well, let's move on. Fourth point, let's spend a little bit of time developing capacity then to recognize the chain of command from controlling roots to producing fruit. So We're going to look at James chapter 4, just a couple of verses. Really, if we had time, we'd be looking at James 4, 1 through 10. But for the sake of time, we're just going to look at a couple of verses. And so let's start by identifying some bad behavior fruit that James explicitly mentions in this passage. So he says, what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? Desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. So what are the fruit that James explicitly mentioned? I think there's two or three in there. Quarreling, fighting. Take that to an extreme, what do you get? Murder, okay? So those are the fruit that James explicitly mentions in this passage. He says, looks out on the church and he says, man, there's people that are going for one another's throat. These are war terms that James is using, battling, fighting. So that's the bad behavior fruit that he says is taking place. So what is the cause that is at the root of this bad fruit, according to James? What causes it? Yeah. Okay. So stuff that we have experienced or gone through in life results in a condition of our heart, which then causes this bad fruit to happen. What does the text specifically say? Okay, so you don't have because you don't ask. I heard a comment over here. Okay. So I think that's interesting, isn't it? What causes people to do the bad stuff, raise their fists, get in quarrels, fights, conflicts? I mean, can you think of an instance where you or someone around you has been in a conflict and you're asking, why are they acting like this? Why are they throwing these words back and forth to one another? Why are they, maybe throwing stuff around or punching walls or slamming books down on the desk or moping around at work or whatever? You know, why are people doing this? James says that it's because there are passions and desires at work in the heart. And those passions and desires active within a person are at war. Now, why do people go to war? What's the intended outcome of war? To get what they want, okay? To establish peace, okay? I think if you were to boil it down, you could probably say that in one way or another, war is always to determine control over a certain area. We go to war because we don't like what this person or this society is doing, either ramifications for them in particular or us included. So we want to control that situation, and so we're going to go to war to gain control to get the desired outcome that we want. Okay. So in a similar sense, there are desires, wants in our heart, and they are warring to gain control of your life to have those desires satisfied. Okay, there's a war that's going on to control that. And so everything that you do in one way or another is rooted in a controlling desire at any particular moment or circumstance. So let me just give you a quick example. Yesterday morning, I knew that I needed to prepare for this class, my notes, finished preparing for it. I knew I had a birthday party in the afternoon. I had other stuff going on. But what was the first thing I did after I got up in the morning, had my devos? The first thing I did was I got up on this half-built shed project of mine, and I stapled holes right through my blue tarp on top of the roof of my shed. Now, why did I do that? What was the controlling desire? get stuff done, okay? Any other thoughts? What was the weather forecast for today? Rain. And even more rain than they were forecasting 2 days ago, okay? So my controlling desire was, even though I wanted to spend time getting ready for this class, even though I knew I had a birthday party to get to, I thought, I do not want rain pouring through all of the wood in the shed, getting everything soaked, and the wood starts to get soggy and swell up, and all the stuff that's in my partially built shed would be getting wet, right? So the controlling desire yesterday morning for me was to save my shed from getting flooded with whatever rain might come my way, okay? So that desire prevailed on my body and caused me to get up on that ladder and poke holes through my nice blue tarp. That's and I could make the same argument about why you got up and ate the breakfast you ate this morning, why you drove the way you drove to church this morning, what you're going to do this afternoon. Somewhere there are desires going on in the heart, and often they're complex desires, and often we lie to ourselves about what those real desires are, and we lie to others about why we're doing what we do, because we want them to think it's not for me, it's for you, or some other noble cause, right? But somewhere underneath all of that are desires of the heart that animate our lives and result in what we do, fruit. Priorities, yeah, so sure. So, and again, that's a way of making value judgments. What's most important right now? What's going to be important 5 minutes from now or a year from now? And so how do I navigate all of those wants and desires into a priority of sequence of action? Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on. So I've pulled a number of statements out of the study guide that Paul Tripp has put together. And so what I want you to do is I want you to try and put in a logical order from controlling root to the producing fruit in these statements that are in your notes and on the screen. So, and they're not in order there, so put a number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. What do you think the actual order of these statements would go on? In other words, what is likely to happen first? What's going to follow from that as second, third, and what's the final thing? Okay, so just take a minute to look at that. Write some numbers in. So something is a gimme for what we've been talking about to start with is the first one. What would be the first one? Desire. I want something. May not even be a sinful thing. Just something you want. You want to eat. You want to sleep. You want to drive to work. You want to be done with this class. I don't know. All right. Number two, let me know what you have for number two. Anyone got that far yet? Demand, okay. Good, good. Now, some of you might have put need there, but the way you list is demand. So we go from I want this to I must have this. Okay, so there's kind of in our thinking and the working of our hearts, we go from, oh, that would be nice. I'd like that car. I'd like this job. I'd like this lady. I like this food too. I gotta have this. I just must find a way to get this. Okay, number three. Okay, need is what I have. So we go from this is something I would like and I really feel like I gotta have to. Then we start to justify it with I need this. I mean, this is really essential for what I need in my life to be and do the things that I want to be and need to do, okay? So now all of a sudden we've gone from something I desire to something I demand to something I need, and then where do we go from there? What's the fourth one? Expectation. Okay, so now we have involved other people, and it gets fun because you get to be involved in helping me get what I need, right? So we all have come to the table of relationships with other people with expectations about how you fit into helping me get my needs met or not, whatever those needs may be, you're part of that. Welcome to the party. Aren't you glad you're here? Okay, and then what follows? Expectation. Okay, disappointment, or you're actually happy with the outcome, but if you're disappointed, it's like, oh, I really needed this, and you didn't do it. I wanted spaghetti and meatballs, and you made me kale salad. I mean, what a disappointment. This is gonna ride heavy on the rest of the evening for us, let me tell you. Okay, so we feel disappointed, or we express affirmation. Yay, you made me hot dogs and hamburgers, something like that. Tri-tip, yeah. Now you're hitting the buttons. Okay, and so depending on how you met my expectations, whether I'm disappointed with you or whether I affirm what you want, the last one then is punishment. Because you didn't do what I expected you to do to meet my need, I'm going to punish you in one way or another. And we can punish people in silent, give you the cold shoulder ways. We can just kind of give a smug look on our face. We can punish people by the way we talk about them to other people that are in their friend circle, or punish them in the more religious way about talking about them to other people who don't know them, so we know that it won't get back to them that we're talking about them. But we're punishing them in our own mind. We're letting it be known that we don't like what that person did to us. Sometimes we try and punish people by getting them demoted or kicked out of a job or a position or a role. Sometimes we make them pay. I mean, literally, we're going to sue them or want them to pay certain money, whatever. So there are all kinds of means that we have of punishing people. And we also have our means of rewarding people, right? So if you did what I expected you to do and you met my need so that I'm happy, I can affirm you, and so I'm going to reward you with words of affirmation. You're amazing. I love that about you. Oh, I wish you would cook for me like that every night. Let's take the evening off. Let's just go for a drive together. That was such an amazing meal. You don't have to cook for the rest of the week. We'll just go fast food. I'm feeling so satisfied. Maybe not. But we do this. We find ways of rewarding people. If you did this for me, let me scratch your back. Because that felt so good, the way you scratched my back. I just want to reward you by scratching your back too. Okay, well, let's move on then. With that in view, this chain of command that typically is taking place in different configurations of stuff that we want to then how we relate to others and things in our life. Let's look at some scenarios and try and identify potential controlling root desires based upon the observed fruit described. Okay, so here's some scenarios. Mike honks and makes irritated gestures at the driver who pulled out in front of him on the highway. Okay, that's the fruit. That's what we saw. You probably saw it all on the way to church this morning. maybe it was you. I don't know. So what is the controlling desire for what Mike, right? Yeah, Mike. Okay, might be feels like someone threatened his safety by cutting him off. So his controlling desire is to be safe. What else? That's great. Believe it or not, I actually wrote that word right in my notes. Unimpeded. Like, don't get in my way, right? You know, my controlling desire is to get down the road unimpeded by some other jerk that doesn't have the right to get in my way, okay? Any other thoughts about what might be controlling desires? Yeah? Okay. That's right. Life is short. Why should I be wasting it on the highway behind this? You know what? Right? Okay. So I think one other that might come into view is just wanting to be respected or feeling disrespected. You know, that someone would be so inconsiderate to just, you know, pop in front of me on the highway. Or here's another one, going, you know, driving through parking lots at Walmart or Raley's or Food Max or whatever, wherever you guys shop, And people are just constantly just walking right out in front of the car, acting as if you weren't driving a two-ton vehicle down the road. You know, it's like, you know, and you're like, couldn't you just give some consideration, some respect to the fact that I'm here too, you know? So I think the desire for some respect and consideration probably also comes into play. All right, let's look at the next one. Katie yells in exasperation. Any Katie's in here? Is this you? I'm the only one that ever picks up anything around here. Okay, what's the controlling desire? Tell us, Katie. I won't pick on you, but if you have the answer, you can tell us. What's the controlling desire? Okay, maybe to get help. This might be a plea. Someone step up. Any other thoughts? Yeah? Oh. Okay, good. Feeling taken advantage of, right? Presumed upon. Any other things that might be at play here? Yeah, okay, yeah. So the desire to have a manageable circumstance in life, maybe a desire to have some time to do something other than pick up someone else's socks, you know? Like maybe I could, you know, go out for a walk or do something fun or read a book, but here I am and I'm picking up plates with spaghetti on them and dirty socks and whatever else that those people leave around your home. Okay, Jack plops down on the couch after work and ignores the screaming kids. What's the controlling desire? Comes home from work. Have you ever done that? Don't bug me. What's going on? What? Self. What about the self is going on? Okay. Okay, my own comfort, right? Let's try and dial that in a little bit more specifically. I'm sorry? Downtime. Okay. Could be anger. Any other thoughts? Okay. A little time to decompress. Fatigue. All right. Not my job. Someone else needs to step up and do this. That other someone in the house who's making dinner right now. Okay. So maybe this is his way of trying to cage the lion so that he doesn't do something that's really bad, you know? I think all of us have had those stressful days at work, right? Things didn't go well, software crashed, someone said a mean, unkind word to you, you didn't get done what you're supposed to get done, you've got someone that's been chatting in your ear all day long, and you just want to sit down and not have to talk, you know? And you've got these screaming kids, and you just don't have the emotional or mental energy to deal with it. You want to just sit down, okay? So stuff going on in the heart that causes you to do the plop-flop thing on the couch after work. All right, we'll do one more. Shannon regularly stays up past midnight on Facebook to catch up on all her Facebook friends are doing. Okay. So, who came up with these names? I did not have you specifically in mind, Shannon, but tell us about it. Why would someone do this? What's the controlling desire? Yeah, FOMO, fear of missing out. My friends have done something amazing and I don't want to miss it, and so I'm going to make sure that I catch it. Okay, good. What else? Yeah? She's just getting to it because someone else left socks and spaghetti plates all over the house. I mean, when else is she going to do this? Thank you for clarifying, Terry. What's that? envy. Can be looking at their circumstance, situation in life, and here they're looking at all the fun that people are having, all the nice trips people are going on, the new cars they're buying, the wonderful kids that they have, and grandbabies, and here I am with, right? And so it can be an expression of that, a way of dealing with our discontent in our life circumstance. I think it can be. It can also be a sense of gratification of being noticed and liked. How many of you have put a post up on Facebook, and then you keep going back to see who commented something good on it? I've done that. You know, did what I wrote mean anything? Was it valuable? You know, until you get the thumbs downs. You know, and then you're like, okay, I'm done looking. Okay, yeah. What a person senses they need to make them happy. And sometimes what they sense they need is legitimate and right, but sometimes it's based upon desires that they've let take control that aren't legitimate, aren't what God says should be controlling desires. And so then they'll produce some bad fruit. Well, I'm running out of time, so... rather than work through our exercise, I'm going to tell you the answer. I don't like to do this, but I'm just going to tell you all about it, okay, in 2 minutes. So there are some principles based upon things we've been discussing that Paul brings out. Our hearts are always being ruled by someone or something. Whatever controls my heart will control my reactions and responses to people and situations in my life. A really important point. The person cutting you off in traffic did not make you mad or angry. The thing that went wrong does not make you act out. What is happening in your heart is just a response to outward circumstances, but it's the heart that makes you angry or makes you lie or makes you do unkind things or steal or whatever it is. Okay. The deepest issues in the human struggle are not issues of pain and suffering. The deepest issue is the issue of worship, because what rules our hearts, what controlling desires are taking place in our heart, those things that we value most deeply will control the way we respond to both suffering and blessing. Whatever that controlling, ruling, idol or good thing, love of God, whatever's ruling in the heart, that's going to bear fruit in your life. It just does. There's no way to not have that happen. And so the way God changes us is to recapture our hearts so that the controlling desire is love for God as high, supreme, he stands alone. And all these other desires get put in their proper place and perspective. And God is the controlling desire in our life. So, what I wanted you to think about, and I'm going to give you the answer to, is strategy, then, for life change. One strategy is a fruit-focused strategy, okay? So we say, all right, you have an issue with anger, being mean, saying unkind things, whatever. I want you to stop fighting. Stop yelling. Drive the speed limit. Pick up your socks, right? And so we're going to focus on the outward stuff. Now, the nice thing about that is it's very tangible. It's observable. You can see results, and you can expect people to do specific things in response to that kind of intervention. The problem with that approach is if you don't actually impact the controlling root desires of a person, that fruit is just going to keep popping up because what created it has not been addressed. It's still there, all right? A root-focused strategy for change is going to focus on what controls the heart. Now, the problem with that is it's less tangible. It's complex, convoluted. It's harder to actually relinquish desires in our heart. We might be able to put some boundaries on the way we behave, but actually letting go of stuff that we desire and want and feel like we need to have is hard. And so for that reason, it can feel like a less desirable, harder approach to life change. But if you have changed your root controlling desires, those changes will lead to lasting life change. And so in this class, the model that we're pursuing is we want to focus on what's going on in the heart so that controlling desires come in line with what God is doing, and therefore we will begin to see lasting fruit develop in our lives. And God will use you in the process of other people to see that happen, even as he's using them in your life to bring about that same change. All right, let me stop there. I'll pray for us, and we'll come back next week. I want to thank you, Lord, for the opportunity for us to think about these things, consider the workings of the heart, God, and I think it's probably evident to all of us that we've got heart work to do. We need you graciously to intervene, to realign the desires of our hearts so that we would become a people that are pleasing to you and that produce fruit in our lives that would be honorable, pleasing to you, and bring blessing to others. And so we ask that you would continue to do that in us and among us. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. You're dismissed. Next week, we'll be looking at serving as an instrument of change. So look forward to that. See you then.